Today's program was brought to you by Mood Magazine, a new international quarterly publication about music and food. For more information, visit moodmusicfood.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 88 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer here at Roberta's.
I'm Zari Kamen. I'm also here at Roberta's.
I'm so glad you're joining me for our second co-hosting gig together.
It gets better every time.
It absolutely does.
Two times a charm.
So since we kind of got into the paleo diet last week, you know, because we're really serious about this thing, and we called Brian the Butcher.
Brian Mayer in Philadelphia.
And we talked to him about butchering the woolly mammoth. And I feel pretty proud because we totally scooped Leonard Lopate.
Obviously.
Because on Leonard Lopate's Food Fridays here on WNYC in New York, he had John Durant, the creator of the paleo diet. And I will tell you, they said not one word about woolly mammoths.
That's crazy.
And, I mean, we really spoke about how butchering the whole animal is completely and totally important to
this
diet.
We're very sustainable in that way.
I mean, and I think that people need to seek out larger game, really.
I also want to make a point that he was wearing toe shoes? Well, feet shoes?
Well, no, so I obviously...
Oh, that was when he was on the Colbert Report.
We do radio. We know we can't see each other. But but then, you know, in further research, they were talking about when he was on the Colbert Report, which was very funny. And obviously, Stephen Colbert was pretty skeptical about the what he kept consistently calling the caveman diet. And he, you know, really the creator of the paleo diet, the caveman diet, the hunter-gatherer diet, whatever you want to call it, was sitting there with a bushy beard, long hair, and he was wearing those toe hole, basically running shoes that look like feet.
They're like socks.
Was he selling Geico?
Like, practically.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I don't know, Jesse, I'm really still into paleo, except that I don't trust a man who wears feet shoes, toe shoes.
You know, I've never tried those on. They creep me out. Like,
I'm,
you know,
creeped.
You know, socks with flip flops.
It's
like kind of what
it is,
I think about
with that.
It is a
deal breaker for me.
Well, he was actually saying on the Colbert Report how he feels that, like, women really like an active man.
That's true.
And that's probably how he shows them that he's active.
But I don't
want those running shoes.
Yeah, I don't need to see their toes.
We have a really good show today, and the gentleman who chimed in was Jason Vincent. He's the executive chef at Knightwood in Chicago, so we'll talk to him a little bit later in the show, but obviously feel free to pipe in, and in our next segment we'll definitely maybe call upon you. Also in studio today, Sarah Crathan. She is co-owner of Sorella on the Lower East Side. She is also the co-star of a new cookbook called Sorella. What is it? It's like cocktails, food, and true stories.
Cocktails, recipes, and true stories from our New York restaurant.
I want to hear about some of those stories.
I definitely want to hear some true stories.
True story!
And so, speaking of stories,
yes.
You know, obviously, Sari and I, we troll the food blogs, we troll the news, and
we burn the midnight oil.
Exactly, and we came across quite a trend this week,
yes.
Or at least in the past months, about these food thefts and food frauds.
Yes. For some reason, there has been a rash, perhaps, of food thefts and frauds in the news.
Ouch.
I'm very concerned. Yeah, rashes don't feel good, and this one certainly doesn't. So I'd like to speak to some of these on the radio because they need to be heard. First of all, very recently, $400,000 worth of walnuts were stolen in California near San Francisco. And it's actually might be the biggest heist of walnuts the state has seen so far, which is shocking. Because
what
the
is
previous
this world coming
because
to?
The previous month, 12,000 pounds of walnuts worth $50,000 were stolen from a trailer near Sacramento. So there's someone or a walnut gang out there that just can't get enough of
it's
these
guys. It's
probably
the people with nut allergies.
Big squirrels.
Big squirrels.
Big squirrels.
I like that theory. I was going to ask you guys, I mean, you're both chefs, what you might do with $400,000 worth of walnuts. I mean, with Thanksgiving coming up and all.
A lot of jokes is all I can think of. You know, it's
and there's Waldorf salad. I don't know.
Yeah. Waldorf salad, walnut salad. Okay, so that's not it. There's also a recent theft of everybody's favorite bourbon that no one can ever get, Pappy Van Winkle. You guys had that before?
Yeah.
It's like liquid gold, right? So 65 cases of 20-year-old Pappy Van Winkle.
And it cools within your stomach and it never goes away. Anyway, sorry. Never mind.
That was stolen in Kentucky on October 15th. And that's a really big deal because it's a very, very small production bourbon. Only 6,000 cases of it are distilled a year.
But that was over weeks.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it wasn't even just like one... You know, just lump like really, sum. Really
They think it was an inside job. So there was probably
like it had to have. Been.
Yeah, it wasn't like
it makes two more sense frat guys than walnuts. One night.
It does make more sense. Yeah.
Although, how does it go with walnuts? Maybe.
Well, we together. I mean, I could totally. Yeah.
Make a
I mean,
next pie. Right. I would think
a bourbon walnut pie. I like that.
The
yeah.
A lot of them.
Maybe this
ever.
Is like a really long. Like a. It's a well planned out. Multi-state.
They might all be working together.
Yeah. I actually really hope
so. Conspiracy.
Yeah. Well, here's another one, and this one comes from England, across the pond. There thieves, multiple thieves, stole 160 sheep from a town called Wool.
Okay, well, we all know what happened there.
Yeah. Whoa. I don't.
A lot of happy dudes.
Yeah.
A lot of happy and, poor dudes.
The owner of the sheep farm is quoted...
A lot of sad sheep.
Wow. The owner of... Is that what happens in Wool? The town of Wool?
I'm assuming. I mean, yeah. So I don't think it was for food purposes. We actually put this in the wrong category of fraud.
Oh.
This
is
they moved them quickly to the town of Condom.
You guys have your minds in the gutter. So the owner of this sheep farm is quoted as saying to be looking out for unusual circumstances for very low prices of lamb.
And wool.
In wool. So there's some black market sheep being sold.
For multiple things.
It's a very versatile animal.
I actually think that's kind of paleo and caveman.
That's what I was thinking, too, because you can animal. Use the whole animal. And very Native American of us, once again, Jesse. Then there's one more thing.
You just got to look towards whichever town is closest to a cliff, that's where you'll find them, because they push back harder.
I got a comedian in here.
Okay. I thought sheep would just jump off the cliff. Isn't that like herding sheep? It's simple.
Maybe it's someone who can't sleep. Get it? Counting sheep?
Absolutely. I don't think we can, right? To be honest, I don't think we can do any better than the sheep story. Thank you so much for all those, the fraud stories, the fraud and the theft stories.
Okay.
I mean, I feel like it's a good talking point, and why in the world?
I know, I'm very curious about it.
I mean,
so many walnuts. That's 140,000 pounds of walnuts.
Well,
how do you transport that?
I think we'll have to do a follow-up story next week to see if they were somehow related cases or if people are just having really expensive Pappy Van Winkle and bar nuts somewhere.
Just full-on walnut Pappy Van Winkle parties.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I'll keep an eye out and an ear out for that.
We're going to take a break here on The Morning After. We're going to come back with Sarah Crathan and hear some true stories about her New York City restaurant, Sorella.
You are listening to Other Shore by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
But I cry now when I'm singing, and there's always something missing. I never thought that it would be this way. I never thought that I would have to say, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'll meet you on that other shore. Was you that taught me how to live? Was you that taught me how to give? Was you that taught me how to love? Now when I love, it's you I'm thinking of. It was you that got the best of me. Now I'm searching for the rest of me. Oh, 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 I'll meet you on that other shore. Oh, don't you know we've been wondering, was it something that we could have done to keep you here with us under the sun? But you made up your mind to leave this broken up world behind. All we can do is hope you made it there and let you know that you're in our prayer. For now we keep on pushing on, and I know one day we'll see that dawn, just to see a smiling face again.
And we're back here on The Morning After. In 2008, Sarah Crathan and her co-owner and chef, Emma Hurst, opened Sorella on the Lower East Side. It is a favorite restaurant of mine, and I'm happy to say I've been going to it since 2008. And I think it's really fantastic that we have her in studio today and that she's got a cookbook out now. So welcome to the studio, Sarah.
Thank you.
So you and Emma met in culinary school, correct?
Yes.
And the two of you, please tell me, take me through like how the two of you got the crazy freaking idea to open a restaurant in New York City, because I don't think I would ever be brave enough to do it.
It was definitely a crazy idea. Emma and I moved to New York kind of at the same time we moved to the city after school. We were roommates, and we both kind of were figuring out what we wanted to do in the city, and we didn't really like anything that we were doing, so we decided on a whim to start like a really makeshift catering company out of our fifth floor walk-up apartment.
It'd be fun to carry stuff down.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't.
Well, I guess up.
I don't think
up.
We did that much business, but we had a lot of fun, and it allowed us to travel, and we started kind of exploring the idea of having a restaurant together because we really liked the way we worked together. But we were terrified to do New York, even though we both loved living here. And all of our kind of mentors and friends and family were like, don't do New York. You're not ready. You're too young. I mean, when we went on that trip, Emma had just turned 21, and I had just turned, I don't know, maybe 22, 23. And then we went to a bunch of big cities. We didn't find anything that felt even close to what New York felt like. So we decided to just kind of jump in and go for it. We took a trip to Italy and spent a lot of time in Piedmont and came back and somehow managed to open a restaurant on the Lower East Side. It just happened really fast.
So it was just the traveling that inspired the kind of the Piedmont idea. Piedmont hospitality,
yeah,
and
the
restaurant.
Piedmont thing was definitely from the trip. We knew we wanted Italy. We came up with like a loose itinerary that took us through different regions, but our first stop, we started in Milan, and then our next stop was Torino, and we were in Alba and all the little villages around Alba, Monforte and Barbaresco and Barolo and all the fun places during truffle season, and actually during the truffle festival. So it was very it was very inspiring. The food was inspiring. The hospitality was inspiring. And we just kind of decided to try to emulate that feeling. It was very family. So it was like old and tradition, something that I think everything gets so modern so fast here. So we just wanted to like dial it back to like grandma style.
Well, and Sorella means sister.
Yes.
And so what did you kind of come up with that? Because you're not sisters.
We're not sisters. Well, we were definitely best friends and had like a close connection, and decided when we were talking about restaurant names, we used a translator online to look up different words and what they had in Italian. And when we saw Sorella, we just kind of, it was like, you know, sister, kinswoman, this kind of relationship, and we decided that that was the perfect thing to call our restaurant.
No, and I remember when it was open, I thought you guys were sisters, actually.
Like, yeah, I mean, my sister is still pissed. she still gets upset whenever people ask if Emma and I are sisters, but nope, we are not sisters.
It's a great name, though, because I feel as someone who, so many of us have moved to New York City, and not many of us were lucky enough to have been born here and raised here and have their family here, and so we've absolutely kind of, at least for me, I've taken on kind of another family
especially in the restaurant industry.
Exactly.
It is one big family anyway. So we wanted that. We wanted a lot of industry people to come. We wanted to be really comfortable and just create kind of like a homey little place. So it was like sister, family. That makes sense.
Sarah, how does that feeling of like working with someone who you feel like is your sister or is your new kind of family, how does that resonate through the food that you make, and how does that affect the recipes that you've chosen for the menus?
I mean, well, we definitely did everything together, which was a lot of fun. And we had a relationship. It wasn't, I do the front of the house, she does the back of the house. I think a lot of times in restaurants, there's a big separation between front and back. And that certainly wasn't there. There was never a screaming fight in the kitchen between the two of us. And we were always on the same team. And in the very beginning, Emma would come out and be pouring water on the floor when we were really busy. Or I would like jump in and help prep on a day that someone didn't show up. And we kind of just because we were so close, we were able to like kind of help each other out all the time, and that kind of emulated through the food and through the staff, and you know, everyone gets along and hangs out way too much, but it's still just...
Is there like a home style kind of feel that you're trying to create, like either aesthetically or just...
Yeah, I mean, I just want, I think ultimately I want people to be comfortable. I think all anybody really wants in a restaurant or a place to go is to find their cheers, and that kind of, everybody knows your name, you know, it's like when you come in and like, you know, we know you, it's, that's the best feeling to me, or to see the same faces and for them to understand the story and see it all progress, like, and it, that's just what I don't know, that's what we hope for anyway.
Now you've launched a cookbook. When was the launch date? Recently.
It hit stores October 29th, and then it was in Williams-Sonoma the 21st.
And so often cookbooks are just focused on the chef, but I really liked that obviously your sisterly connection, you know, had your elements as the front of house and the food, the wine side, cocktail side, and then Emma's side with the food. Was that deliberate?
Oh yeah, we definitely wanted something different. We're different, so we wanted it to be, you know, bits of our story, not too intense. We wanted it to, you know, be fun and interesting. But there are two sides of the restaurant story, and you can't just talk about the food. There's someone else involved who delivers that message to your customers. So we wanted that to, you know, be very clear in the book.
And there's, we were talking a little bit earlier, but there's a lot of glamorous photos in the cookbook. And so it's not just kind of the food side, but it's also these lifestyle kind of photos of you and Emma. Whose idea was it to put the, like, how we calm down, how we keep it together a bit.
That was me. It was really important to me that we mentioned that. We both found like Pilates early on in opening up the restaurant, and it's really changed the way that we, you know, walk and think, and it's certainly a big part of being able to do what we do. And, you know, you work a lot of hours and you play hard and your body takes a big beating. So we just kind of found a way to like build exercise into how we do things, whether it's, you know, like sneaking out in the middle of the day to go take a class, or I would go during family meal to run over the bridge, just something to kind of like get that energy out in a positive way.
Because it's a super high stress industry.
Yeah.
And if you don't let it out, then things happen. And I was talking earlier today with my girlfriend Erin, and she kind of thought of this. You know, is this a new generation of restaurateurs and chefs who are taking into mind their own bodies and the toll that restaurants take on you? And I definitely want to bring Jason into this conversation because, you know, while Charlie Trotter, you know, infamous chef in Chicago, didn't die in a kitchen or anything like that, I mean, I can only imagine that certain elements, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, all of that kind of resulted in a really early demise, and it's a shame. So I don't know, I guess I just want to pose that question to the two of you, you know, younger chefs, and restaurateurs in this, you know, in our generation right now, do you think that's a trend? Do you think people are focusing on that?
I mean, I think I definitely see it. If you look at the marathon alone and all the New York City restaurateurs who get involved in it every year. I think that at this point, we're at that point where it's like you can't ignore all the things. You talk about paleo and all these other trends and all the gluten-free, all the diets and things that people are doing now. I don't think as chefs we can just say like, oh, no, you can eat whatever you want and you should always, you know, you don't need to exercise, just eat and drink and do it without there being, you know, some sort of a consequence. You have to do something to counteract all the abuse that you put on your body.
Jason?
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, physically is incredibly important, and, you know, I'm still finding my path to that, honestly. But mentally, you know, I'm going to sell therapy right now. Like, it's huge. Everybody should have a shrink. Everybody on the planet should have a shrink. And chefs and, you know, I encourage my staff, like, I've given recommendations for my shrink, you know, to my sous chefs and things like that. And it's holistic is probably the wrong word, because at the same time, like, you're going into work every day, like, completely defying what your body is supposed to do and what your mind's supposed to do. But I mean, at the end of the day, you got to get right, and you got to get right so you can, you know, it's masochistic, but so you can do it again. And, you know, running is amazing. It, you know, I, like there was a, like the French Laundry cookbook came out when I was, I don't know, in high school. And everybody read it, but it's like those little snippets of, you know, Thomas Keller saying, like, my knees hurt. I can't do this. And it's just like one tiny, it's like this big, you know, in that whole book. But it's like if you mind grind over that book and you process everything that he says, which you should, and take it for what it is, my knees hurt is such a huge statement coming from that guy who is, the, you know, everything that everybody wants to be. You know, my knees hurt. You know what I mean? It's like, do something about it. Don't just let them hurt, you know, like run, stretch, do all the stuff, go to therapy, like, you know, make it possible, because it's such a hard business day in, day out. You got to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, it's our job as this generation to make sure we're teaching and learning and fixing our guys, our family. You know, she referred to it as family meal. It's like, even that is so important. Like, we spend so much time together, and it's like, why would you, you know, sit across from somebody that you're having family meal with and not be concerned about them, about their general welfare, you know?
I want to get back to that, and I want to talk more about Charlie Trotter with you and how that's impacted young chefs like yourself in Chicago. But I have a question for you, Sarah, since we were talking about stories and like how your stories and Emma's stories, and like the one thing that really struck me about the cookbook is I felt like this was a little bit more with Emma, but you really get a sense of like who she is when she's not in the kitchen. And there's so many photos that are very stylized, and it's very editorial, and it's like sexy and fresh. And I want to hear more about why those are in a cookbook. I've never seen a book before where you saw the chef, you know, really outside of his or her element, and just kind of like it sparks the imagination. Like, who is this person? Like, I know I see their food, but their food is telling a totally different story than, you know, like this very glamorous photo of like a woman with lipstick looking in the mirror.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's met Emma knows that she certainly doesn't fall into any category with the way that chefs act. I think she wore whites for the first 2 days Sorella was open, and then she was like, I'm done with this. I don't like the way I look in whites. And she was cooking in like Lululemon pants and a black shirt every night. Another reason for the photos in the cookbook too is to kind of show that, you know, Emma is now my partner, but no longer the chef at Sorella. We have a new chef, Molly Nickerson, and she really didn't want, as much as we were telling the story of before and how we all started it, she wanted it to be, you know, about the two of us and like who we've become as women. And yes, there's this food and all these things in the background, but we're also these people, and the restaurant has been very personal. It's, you know, it's us at there every, it was us there every day. We built it together. We became adults in it together. We learned all sorts of things that we never thought we'd be able to handle. And she just, you know, Emma's Emma, and she really wanted to like dress up and have fun, and this be this like, it was like her last thing that with Sorella, so she wanted it to be like her kind of her legacy. And if, as I said, if you meet her and you go out with her and you hang out with her, like that's what Emma looks like. So yeah, she just kind of had fun with it, and I think it came out. It really shows how different we are in every way, but that somehow we did this together.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the two of you growing up with this restaurant, but the neighborhood around you is also completely changed. I mean, you're on Allen below Delancey, which, yeah. I mean, there's kind of that, like, the doomed former Allen and Delancey space where no one...
On the other side.
On the other side of Delancey, actually north of Delancey. And, you know, you guys obviously have staying power, but what have you noticed within the neighborhood since you opened?
I mean, it's changed a lot. I think right now is when it's really, really changing with what's kind of coming. I think it's everything's moving a little further south, so we're getting some more of the like Lower East Side crowd, and there's definitely, I mean, it was very Chinatown when we opened. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only like big restaurant on the block outside of Allen and Delancey was Congee Village. And you know, all the great dollar dumplings that exist on our block, which we consumed a lot of. And then, you know, slowly little things started to open here and there. But now we've got, like, I think there's, like, a pizza place opening up on Broome and Allen, which is kind of crazy for the neighborhood. And there's, like, hotels coming and all these things that are happening. And it's exciting for us to see that the neighborhood is changing. I have no idea what to expect. It's still, like, a really stinky block. There's still a lot of cats.
Especially in the summertime.
It's funny because I was reading, I think it was Leah Cohen was talking about all the problems with Pig and Cow that she's had since it's opened, about like cats and equipment and just the things that are happening that have been hard. And I kind of was laughing because it was like, wow, I've had those same exact problems for 5 years. Maybe I should have talked about them on a blog. Maybe that would have changed something faster. I mean, there's this, like, really weird protection of these cats in the neighborhood, so I don't know how much the neighborhood can actually change, because I get, like, a letter from, like, the cat mayor, because we put a sign up asking people not to feed these cats anymore, because they have made a mess of the behind my dining room, which you've been to. It's, like, right behind it is, like, Cat Village, and on a hot summer day, the smell that comes through the emergency exit is, like, I mean, we walk around burning herbs in a pan, and people think we're, like, casting spells. It's like, no, you don't, trust me, you need us to do this. But there's,
is the cat mayor a cat?
I don't know. I got the letter, and I was, like, so excited to respond to it, so I haven't done that yet.
Very Murakami-esque.
Yeah, it's very, they're very protective of these cats, because they think that they are stopping vermin in the neighborhood, but maybe they would do that if they weren't being fed cat food, which would stop them from hunting. So there's definitely things about the neighborhood that I think will always be challenging for restaurants, health
it's
department.
Probably a good sign they're around, because that also means they're not going into the food.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Or are they? Or there would be more of them. I mean, they're not going into our food.
Well, obviously.
Again, I've been trying to figure out for a long time how dumplings can be four for a dollar. I just can't figure it out.
Oh. And that's the point. You just don't want
just
to.
Can't
just don't figure it out. Don't
Some
ever
questions are better
figure
left
it out.
And my brother is a doctor, so he's always like, he thinks about numbers, and he'd say, Sarah, I can think about it over and over again, and there's just no way that there's a profit. I'm like, stop trying to figure it out. They're pretty good, right?
Oh man, so new chef, are there, you know, sticking to kind of the same recipes, the same ideas, and adding upon them?
A lot of the food has changed tremendously. Molly was our kind of opening sous chef, and her and Emma worked well together. They created a lot of food together, and then Molly had left. She traveled. She was she opened up the Lincoln, and then she was at Maria for a while. I think she's dialed it back to being very Italian. Emma will say this, and we can say it. She had serious ADD in the kitchen, and her idea of changing a menu item was like, okay, I'm absolutely sick of tasting and making this, so I'm changing it. And I'd be like, no, but people love it. She's like, I don't care. I'm taking it off. Molly is very much more like focused on seasonality and changing things when it makes sense to change them, and just being really traditional. The pasta has gotten, I mean, we've always had great pasta, but I think it's really outstanding right now. And she took off the pâté, which everyone knew as being like the signature Sorella dish with the chicken liver mousse, and she turned it into a really epic pork rillette dish that I think is you know, better, but don't tell anyone. No, I'm just kidding.
Don't tell the radio.
Except our million listeners.
Yeah.
Millions.
Savvy.
Hundreds.
It's definitely changed, but it's sticking to that same mentality that we always had. It's simple food. It doesn't take 5 days to make. It's not, you know, like the in the style of the cookbook. If you read the recipes in the cookbook, they are actually easy to follow, easy to make. So good things.
So if anybody wants to come to Sorella, what's your address?
It's 95 Allen, between Delancey and Broome.
And what's the website?
SorellaNYC.com.
That's easy enough. SorellaNYC.com. Thank you so much for joining us,
Thank
Sarah.
Thank you for having me. This
and
is
check
fun.
Out their cookbook. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with Jason Vincent from Nightwood in Chicago.
You're listening to In Your Power by the California Honey Drops on the heritageradionetwork.org. Been some rocks in my road. Girl, I thought you should know.
What's Mood? Mood is a quarterly magazine about music and food. For its creators, not many things can beat a good record and a delicious meal. Maybe a well-written story or a gorgeous photo. Well, that's all in Mood. The magazine looks at music and food in a cohesive and unique way, with a keen eye to design and high-quality writing. Its contributors are located around the globe, and the stories span accordingly. Check it out today at moodmusicfood.com. That's moodmusicfood.com.
We're back here on The Morning After, all the way from the Pilsen neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. Mr. Jason Vincent.
Hi.
Of Nightwood. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
I was telling Jason earlier, I was born in Chicago, and was lucky enough when I was in college to get an internship at NBC, and I was taken to what I thought was the coolest restaurant I'd ever been to. It was called Lula Cafe. And Jason ended up working there, I think, maybe a year later. This was 2004. And
right, yeah.
A year later, and that basically started the partnership, which got you to where you are, correct?
Yeah. I moved to Chicago, just kind of staged a few places and made some bad decisions as far as like who to do tastings for, like the Levy Group and things like that. You know, I thought I was going for a sous chef job at, you know, Spiaggia or something, and all of a sudden the guy pulls me in and he's like, okay, so we want you to do a tasting. We need three courses, two plates each of food that you could take on an airplane. And essentially the job I was tasting for was the executive sous chef of their airport development, yada yada yada. So I was like, you know, and the guy's like, I love Restaurant Depot, and like, oh, it's got everything. And I'm just like, oh my god, I'm gonna shoot myself in the head right
like
now.
I'm not your.
He's like,
you're so, like, where is Papa?
And I did the whole tasting, and he's like, so at the end of it, he's like, food is great. Like, end of the day, if you're serving asparagus out of season, is that a problem? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. That's a problem. And I never got, that's the last I heard of him. Until I saw him at the Restaurant Depot, because I was in the juice, and I was like, all right, I need this. And like, I saw him, he's like, place is great, right? I'm like, oh.
Amazing. So from Lula, now you have opened as executive chef Nightwood. How long has that been in operation?
Nightwood will be 5 in May.
Amazing. And speaking of the don't serve asparagus out of season, that's kind of your focus there, correct?
It is. You know, like we developed all these like great relationships, and it really seems like a shame to burn the bridge. However, you know, the relationship extends out of the Midwest. It's like we did this dinner at City Grit last night. The first course was, you know, Dungeness crab, and like we have a really great guy who, you know, gets us Dungeness crab, and it's like we totally cheat, but we go for delicious, and we, you know, try not to make our footprint too big, but at the same time, you know, I like sardines, I like crab, I like stuff that we're not going to get out of the lake.
Yeah, you know? Coming out of, so do you, actually, I don't know what comes locally out of Lake Michigan.
Lake Michigan, not so much. Like, you got to go pretty far up north to get something that's not going to be scary to eat. They used to have, salmon, you know, you can still do salmon fishing, like, northern Lake Michigan. My wife's from Madison, so, like, we'll go up, like, you know, way north, Green Bay, like, that area. There's great fish, sturgeon. They have a 1 fish per year limit on sturgeon in the lake. Like, you can catch 1, and that's it.
Because the population is not growing?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Every person can catch one, or only one person can catch
one? Any person with a license.
It's like a lottery. There will be one sturgeon. I'm the guy who gets to catch a sturgeon.
But there's, you know, we serve walleye right now. Walleye pike is I think, maybe my favorite fish ever. Like, you'll be interested in this. The gelatin level in walleye is so thick. It's like a, you can make like a gelatinous, like, pork type stock out of it. So we had all this roasted walleye one night, and we packed it, you know, into a quart container to, you know, refrigerate it overnight, put it in a drawer, and the gelatin level was so high that you could unmold it, and it totally held its form, just like this cup, and then you could slice it.
Wow.
So we made all these crazy terrines. Lake fish is jelly. Interesting.
Awesome.
Yeah, totally.
Well, so you're at City Grit, that's why you're in New York City right now, but you've kind of been on this whirlwind. You just were named one of Food & Wine's Best New Chefs.
It's nuts.
So, I mean, I love that they call you Best New Chef, because you're like, I've been doing this for a while.
No, I'll take it. They can call me whatever they want.
So, I mean, I guess what's happened since then?
Yeah, like I was,
you got
like
radio talk shows and stuff.
Yeah, right. Like I was saying, man, it's like a lot of new normal. You know, half the stuff that's happened, I'm like, okay, so how do I extend that? How do I keep that going? And then the other half is like, I never want that to happen again, you know? But it's, you know, it's something for sure. It's a lot of figuring out, you know. I'm married. We've been married 7 years, almost 7 years. And we have a 3-year-old, and, you know, I don't want to miss my kid growing up, you know? So we've talked about it a lot. Like, even no matter what goes on, I think I'm gonna get it tattooed on me. It's, you know, family then restaurant, like, because it's, I can see it being really easy to blow it, you
so
know,
kind of ride on the train of this celebrity chef kind of thing.
Dude, I don't want to be famous. I want to cook dinner. I do want to make people happy. You know, I don't want to turn, I don't know. I want to figure it out. I want to be better at what I'm doing, but I want to see my kid grow up. I want to spend time with my wife, and I don't want it to just be Sunday nights and Tuesdays, you know, like, she doesn't deserve that. Mm-hmm. She deserves to be taken out on Saturday night. You know, she's unbelievable.
Well, it's a really good mindset to stick to. Please do it. And I think this kind of ties into another award that I saw that you guys got, which was Best Neighborhood Restaurant from the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, I think it's fantastic to be named Best New Chef of, you know, on Food & Wine, to be a great cook, to be a great chef, to, you know, buy the right product from the right people in the right season. But something that is really hard to cultivate is the love of the neighborhood. And I think that's something to be really proud of.
I think, you know, like, people in my position have weird relationships with radio people and bloggers and news people, and, like, the way the newspaper industry is kind of going, it's the, you know, cream rises to the top, but the whey is getting really thin type of thing. The guys at the Tribune who gave us that award are class acts. They're nice guys. They fact check. You know, that's why I feel validated having that one. Mm-hmm. Phil Vitale, who's a longtime Chicago Tribune reviewer, restaurant reviewer, Kevin Pang, Alex Garcia, who's a photographer. Like, they are class acts. And that's what made me feel real good about it. It's those guys saying, hey, man, nice job, you know, and for that, you can be like, oh, you know, instead of being, oh, shucks, you can be like, thanks, you know.
Yeah. And feel legit about it.
Totally.
Yeah. Now, when I lived in Chicago, I spent no time on the South Side. What, the Pilsen neighborhood was not something that I have any idea about. Is it kind of up and coming, or it's already established as like a food neighborhood? What's it like there?
It's a heavily Mexican neighborhood. Great Mexican food. A lot of cat dumplings. Cat tacos.
Et cetera.
Yeah, you know,
you're really starting trouble. I feel like the cats are going to come after
the cat bear.
Us.
Cats come out at night. Essentially, the idea behind it was Lula opened up in Logan Square on the north side 14 years ago.
Which now, there was not a lot there.
There was nothing. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, Jason Hamill and Leah Childs, the owners of both restaurants, they were, you know, bohemian, like, writer, artist, like, that kind of thing. And they were working at this cafe called Logan Beach Cafe. And they gave it to them. They were like, oh, we're working here, and we're going to make soup, and we're going to sell it to people and whatever. And the owner's like, you know, I don't really want to do this anymore. Want it? And that's how Lula came to be.
Oh, my. I had no idea.
Right? I mean, it started off. Lula started off as a space. I mean, nobody can see it, but maybe it was like a shotgun, whatever you call it, like 20 by 50, you know? Kitchen in the back, like all like little rishodes, like no hood, no nothing, zero. And like the guys from like Tortoise lived in the neighborhood and like whatever, and like the cool kids went there.
There was like, there's like a punk rock club upstairs, and that you had like a jar of like pins, and I thought that was so, I was like,
oh man, I forgot
was so
pins.
Into pins at the time.
I have I pins, I forgot pin. Them.
But I see, so like, so moving, so putting this restaurant in the Pilsen neighborhood was kind of the same idea.
It was, and you know, honestly, like, we're, you know, it's not, it's, they're both such things, you know, like, we really do refer to ourselves as, like, the Seinfeld of restaurants, like, where it's just, like, we didn't have a thing we were gonna do, we were just gonna open, you know, but the thing with
restaurant about nothing.
Do you know what I mean? But the thing about Nightwood is it costs a lot of money to open it.
It so looks it's much like, bigger than Lula.
It's not, you know, yeah. What? It's not bigger. Now, Lula's actually moved three storefronts over. They've accepted three. Like, it's huge. It's beautiful right now. Like, they put in a marble bar, knocked down, like, the north wall. It's gorgeous. And they're doing amazing, amazing, amazing food.
But the restaurant about nothing.
So here we are. You know, I don't know. Like, we knew we wanted to do another restaurant, and I wanted the opportunity, and, you know, Jason and Leah trusted me to do it, and, you know, the first couple of years were really friggin' hard, you know, and I spent time at, you know, Arzak in San Sebastian, which is, like,
I saw that amazing,
cerebral, crazy. And then time at 4th Street in Portland, Maine, which is super, like, here you go. And I was like, well, we can do both. But, I had no idea how to do it. And so it's taken us years to just figure it out. And I think we're starting to get better at it, I guess.
I think that's a good way to look at it, too.
It seems like there would be some advantages to being, like, a hyper-seasonal local restaurant in, you know, Illinois, as opposed to in the middle of New York City. And I saw that you guys handwrite the menu every day.
Every day.
Well, what's the process? I mean, are you really going to the markets every single day? Or, like, how often does the menu change?
For the first... I mean, that's... Okay, so for the first 2 years, we literally crumpled up yesterday's menu, threw it away, and started again. Literally going to the market every single day. And like I said, we have a really good relationship with the farmers, so sometimes they would just show up at the back door, and like that, you know, it sounds cliche and like overly romanticized or whatever. It's like, farmer shows up at the back door and this is the best stuff he's got, but it was true. Then I had a daughter. Like, so instead of going into the restaurant literally at 7 a.m. every day and just, how do we knock it out of the park, you know, 1 through 20 every single day, with cooks coming in at, you know, hours early, like, and then explaining every single dish to them, and this is what we're doing, and this is how, like, there's no way to communicate.
Your waiters must have hated you.
Oh my God. You have no idea.
I can't
imagine.
Hate
it.
Yeah.
Hate it.
Yeah, but I bet that there were those servers who, this is the kind of server I was like, I want to learn something new every single day, and I want it to feel fresh and
But I was I was so behind the eight ball every day. Okay. So it's like, you know, you sit down at 5 o'clock, service starts at 5:30, and there's just not that time. I mean, people are writing frantically, and there's no way to communicate. Like, we were blowing it. Mm-hmm. We blew it. And then I had a daughter and said to, like, we had to just, I wanted to see her, you know, I wanted to be there for my kid, not miss that. So I was like, all right, well, let's start having like menu items where we have a dish
and it stays
on the menu
for more than
5.5 hours,
yeah.
You know? Which is great. And like, you guys can't see, but my sous chef, Aaron, is here. And, you know, Aaron started as, he can tell you some stories. He was our first intern like 5.5 years ago. He staged at Lula for Nightwood, hired him. He worked for free for 6 months, you know, like go. And that's what we figured out is like, not only do you have to like develop a menu and be okay with small pitfalls and as long as you're like climbing out of them quickly, but it's people, you know. Chicago, I'm sure New York is the same way, is it's hard to find people who know and care. And we kind of started from ground zero, like, just okay, we're gonna hire, if they knock on the back door and they want a job, I don't like not paying people, but you know, I can validate it if, you know, if somebody needs to stand over you for the first 3 months and make sure you're not screwing up, mm-hmm. I don't need to pay you. But
God, I wish that could work everywhere.
I'm glad this radio show doesn't broadcast in Chicago.
Oh yeah, the internet online. The internet doesn't go anywhere.
It's international.
Before we wrap things up, I do want to return to Sari's question, or the kind of universal question that we had talked about Charlie Trotter and his influence on young chefs in Chicago.
Huge, incredible.
Yeah, I'm just really curious what the climate has been like since his passing. Does it really feel like an end of an era?
It's, I mean, beyond, no, I mean, that's not even deep enough.
Yeah.
It's different. It's very different. Charlie was a character. He was something. Even before the restaurant closed, you know, like, you always hear Charlie Trotter stories, like crazy things that he did and whatever. One of the guys in my Best New Chef class was there for 5 years, so we've talked about it a lot. Justin Cogley and Carmel. It's a guy you never think is gonna die.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, it's like one of those, like, it never crossed my mind. I don't think it ever crossed anybody's mind. Like, he's like Bocuse. He's like, he doesn't die,
mm-hmm.
you know, or he dies when he's ready.
Is there any takeaway? I mean, have you guys, you know, as a community of chefs, have you been able to come together, and has there been any sort of like revelation that's come out of it? Whether it has to do with like maybe the level of stress that he carried with him in the kitchen, or just, you know, all of the good things, that all the influence that was passed on. Or is it too soon?
Well, I think it's respectful to think about the good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's, you know, like, one of the things he was trying to do vehemently before he died was sell the buildings that housed the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe now, you know, somebody, you know, it could easily be James Beard House Midwest. You know, it's a beautiful space. It's got rad equipment. It'd be easy to curate. You know, I shouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be curatable. But, you know, it'd be awesome, and it'd be an homage, and, you know, you think about the good, and not, you know,
there needs to be a
nut job chef, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. If there's anything we can take away, I think it's be the best. And if there's something that we can't take away, it's treat people nice, you know?
Yeah. But it's also, I mean, really goes back to what you said, which was lovely, the way you put it about, like, making sure there's time to see your family and time to see your children grow.
It's huge.
I think that's the biggest thing of our generation, of what's happening, is that people are making time for families and doing that. I mean, when I graduated from culinary school, the speaker at our graduation said, if you want to have a family, forget it now. And if you want this, forget it now. And afterwards, my mother was almost in tears, like, are we seriously never going to see you again? I was like, no, we'll figure it out. We'll find a way to make it work.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, and for generations,
you give
it's
up
like,
holidays, you give up so many things, totally. And weddings, all these things you can't just take on a whim. I mean, I'm a sucker. I never say no to staff if they want time off for something. And people tell me I'm crazy for it, but it's like, I don't know. Life's too short. You never know what's going to happen. And
it doesn't make sense for our industry.
At the end of the day, I mean, we're in hospitality. We take care of people. So why would we ever want miserable people working for us saying, like, I don't have a life outside of my job. I haven't seen my mom in this long. Or I really want to have a family, and I'll never be able to have a family. Not to mention afford a family with what we do. Right. So.
It's the thing our industry's not known for. Like, we don't sit there and go, oh, yeah, this is the status quo, so this is how it is. But it seems like in that one regard, everybody, you know, there are people who are like, okay, so you just don't see your family and yada, yada, yada. It's like, no. Like, that we can work on that. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, let's fix that.
Let's all get together and figure this out. We can do it. Yeah. We've changed it enough. Chefs used to be, you know, a gross position that nobody wanted, and now it's a celebrity position that everybody wants, so... We've changed in that regard. There's no reason we can't find the balance.
Let's get on that. Absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. I try to do the same things in my restaurant as well. And I need to remind myself to do those things for myself.
You have to remind yourself a lot. Yeah. Like, you gotta do it all the time, even when you don't want to, you know?
It always takes that big, like... thing, if whether it be a death of a very important chef, to be like, hold on a second, like if that happened tomorrow, what would I regret right now, and if what can I do to change that?
Yeah. Nothing. You'd be dead.
It's a really good point.
You wouldn't regret anything.
We don't know what happens. Okay.
Cat dumplings. You guys are amazing.
Yeah.
Really great show today.
You'd be cat dumplings.
Jason, I guess quick, give us the website for Knightwood.
It's knightwoodrestaurant.com. The Twitter is Knightwood Pilsen, and mine is JasonVincent00.
You're used to doing this, aren't you?
No, that's the first time. I really got to pee. I was just trying to wrap it up.
So there was actually, it wasn't just 00. It was like something else after that. You're just getting out of here.
Figure out the rest.
Well, thank you so much. So visit Sarah at Sorella and Jason at Knightwood if you're in Chicago. This has been a great show, Sari. Thank you so much.
I loved this show. You guys are awesome.
Thank you for having us.
This is The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.